Most of you know she goes all over the world and teaches, and is pretty much on the move all the time. She spends 6 months here and 6 months everywhere else, and she says she talks really quickly in that Australian accent, so I couldn't get every word written down. But she goes all over the place, including Mongolia, Russia. She just came back from Israel, as well as the more tropical islands and popular vacation spots like Paris and Rome. So I would like to welcome the Venerable Robina Corden.
So I'll just sing a little prayer to start off with. Remembering that prayers aren't necessarily some empty ritual. They're actually a series of thoughts. And Buddha says that every thought we have is a seed that we plant in our mind that will bring a fruit similar to that seed in terms of our future experiences. In fact, this is the creative principle, according to Buddha. So given this, then every thought we have really does count. So this prayer which we're singing in Tibetan, the first part of it, if we're Buddhists already, then what it's doing is expressing our reliance upon the Buddha, his teachings, the spiritual community. And if we're not, then that's okay, just leave it. And then the second part of the prayer is expressing our altruistic motivation for doing this activity of listening to these ideas of the Buddha, seeing if there's something reasonable within them that we can apply to our own lives. This is what we're singing. So have those thoughts, you know, in your mind. Because also it's said that, according to Buddha, it's the motivation, the reason for doing something is the main determining factor in the result that will come from what we do, say, and think. Not the thing itself, the motivation. So our motivation is something altruistic. I'm listening to these teachings, thinking about their meaning, seeing if there's something to apply to my life, so that I can develop my marvelous qualities that Buddha says we all possess innately, so that in turn I can be useful to others. This is why I'm here. Sangye chadang tsokye chognam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chun yen gi personam ki dro la penche sangye dropa shok. Sangye chadang tsokye chognam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chanyen gi personam ki dro la penche sangye drupa shok. Sangye chadang tsokye chognam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chanyen gi personam ki dro la penche sangye drupa shok. Well, why we want to change our mind is because, according to Buddha, that's the source of whether we're happy or whether we suffer. It's the source. I mean, mind. You could even say that mind is really the creator. You know, not in the magic wand sort of sense, but in an evolutionary, organic sense, that whatever we say, do, and think is literally, in Buddhist terms, the creative principle. There isn't definitely Buddha talks about superior being or beings, plural. You know, Buddha means this. But Buddha is not asserting that the job of a superior being is to create beings. And so, you know, if we ask the question to Buddha, well, who made me? Buddha would say, well, honey, you made you, you know. In a very real sense, Buddha is saying this, that the mind, what is in our mind, our thoughts, our feelings, unconscious, subconscious, intellect, emotions, which is all, which is encompassed by the word mind, this is the source. This is the creative energy. This is the creative principle. So therefore, absolutely, we need to know our minds. It's the job of a Buddhist, you know. As Lama Yeshe would say, the job is to be our own therapist. And it sounds cute, but it really is profoundly true. Or as Lama Zopa Rinpoche would say, the workshop is in the mind. So if it's true, if we need to change our... I mean, why would you want to change your mind? Well, it seems fairly logical. The only reason to change something is if you can make it better. So, you know, the starting point, or the reference point, if you like, for a person who's a Buddhist, is Buddha's assertion that every living being necessarily, you know, possesses the potential innately to have this mind of theirs fully developed, beyond which it can't be developed further. So there's a nice analogy that Mahayana Buddhism uses, that a bird needs two wings. And so a person who's fully developed their mind is a person who has achieved the wisdom wing and the compassion wing. Another word for this is Buddha. It's Sanskrit, it means fully awake, which actually has a very interesting implication, doesn't it? The implication being that we're asleep now. This is very much how Buddha talks, you know. And so where all this occurs is in this mind of ours. And so so one way of looking at it is, if we ask the question, do we want to be happy? It sounds almost simplistic, you know. But I think we can very definitely say yes. Do we want to suffer? We would say no. So one of the approaches of this, one of the characteristics of this fully developed mind, this Buddhahood, or enlightenment, these words are synonymous, one of the characteristics is fully developed happiness, complete contentment, fulfillment, wholeness, whatever words you want, you know. So Buddha's saying, we all have this potential. And one of the things actually that's incredibly important when we listen to Buddha's ideas, Buddha's teachings, and this I can't stress enough, you know, I think the second we hear the word religion or spiritual, we immediately get rather vague. We immediately seem to lose common sense, you know. I mean, when we hear something called science or numbers, or, you know, we're very practical. We know it's to do with real, touchable things. But somehow the moment we hear spiritual and religious, we don't think it's real, touchable, doable, you know. It's something beyond now. It's something somewhere else in the sky. But somehow the approach in Buddhism is it's the exact same attitude that we would have towards learning numbers, learning how to make cakes, learning how to become a carpenter. It's something you learn the theory, you learn a very precise theory. You're not vague about it when you're learning numbers, you know. It's very precise. And in fact, the precision and clarity and depth of analysis that we know we need to use to understand physical phenomena is exactly what Buddha demands of us when we need to, you know, in the understanding of our own mind, understanding of how the universe is, how the world is, what makes it happen, you know. And so it's incredibly important when we listen to Buddha's teachings. It's the same way that we'd listen to Einstein telling us about his findings about relativity. You wouldn't hear it as something that you just have to believe. You don't hear it as something metaphysical. Yes, maybe difficult, but we hear it as something real, practical, that he has, through his own experience, found, you know, discovered. Not invented, but found, observed. Well, that exactly is the approach with Buddha. In other words, probably a fundamental difference between most religious paths and Buddhist approach is that the teachings of Buddhism, Buddha's ideas, aren't revealed to him by somebody, which is the usual view. And I'm not criticizing, nothing wrong, but I'm just saying the Buddhist view is not that one. There's nothing revealed about Buddha's teachings. What Buddha's view of reality is simply Buddha's findings about how things exist, what mind is, what causes things to happen, what is happiness, what is suffering, what are beings, where do they come from, the universe, why happiness, why suffering, why Mother Teresa, why Osama bin Laden, whatever, you know. In just the same way that we know, if we had Einstein up here telling us about his findings, we would listen, we'd listen with respect, and we would know that if we wanted to find this out for ourselves, that the steps are all there for us in order to discover absolutely for ourselves that it is so, you know. Well, that's the attitude to take with Buddha's teachings. He's saying, in a sense, don't believe a single word I'm telling you. listen to it. If there's something reasonable there, then we go into it and we can investigate for ourselves whether or not it is true. There's something very interesting in this. You know, it's like when we think of happiness, we think of spiritual, we think of being kind to others, we would rarely think about wisdom. We would rarely think about knowing things as they are. We would rarely think about finding truth. They seem to be two completely different pursuits. Well, actually, you know, then in Buddhist terms, they're not. You know, they intersect perfectly. Buddha's views of reality, Buddha's philosophy, Buddha's views about what exists, how things are, completely intersect with Buddha's, you know, understanding of mind. In other words, Buddha's philosophy and psychology intersect perfectly. For a Buddhist, there's no contradiction between these. There's no contradiction between philosophy, religion, way of life, psychological. They all come together. They must come together. In just the same way, again, if you were to hear a recipe for a cake, you know that necessarily everything in that recipe has to count precisely and will bring you the result of the cake. You don't have something in a recipe, you know, because you like the sound of it. You like the look of three lemons, you know. Sounds nice, say. Whatever's in that recipe has to bring you the experience of that cake. So Buddha's philosophy is, in a sense, his recipe, you know. And where they intersect is very interesting, you know. What Buddha's saying is that the extent to which our minds are not in sync with how things are is the extent to which we suffer. So the pursuit of a Buddhist, the pursuit of happiness, is the pursuit of truth, necessarily. Because Buddha is saying, as we remove from our minds the veils that prevent us from seeing things as they are, not only prevent us from seeing things as they are, but cause us to live in a fantasy world. As we remove these, so we become happier. We become clearer, and we become happier. Because it's being caught up in, as Buddha would refer to them, as the delusions, the unhappy emotions that are the cause of our suffering, and why they cause us suffering is because we're not in touch with reality. So there's this complete relationship, you know, between how things exist, so-called philosophy, and experiences, the mind, you know, psychology. So, okay, Buddha's saying, like I said, Buddha is saying that each of us, if you exist, if you're a sentient being, which is the English term usually used to translate the Tibetan term semchen, which means mind possessor. If you're a mind possessor, then necessarily you're a potential Buddha, you know. And again, hearing this as a word that we call religious, hear it as something psychological. In Buddhist terms, the logical extension of where we are now, that if we can begin to develop from where we are now, we will end up as a Buddha. It's not some leap somewhere into some metaphysical realm after this ordinary physical one. It's a logical, natural, organic, step-by-step process. And you can actually say it's psychological. So, you know, that sounds limiting in some way, because we tend to have a view that, you know, when we use the word psychology, we use our own Western models of the mind, you know. So when we hear that Buddha says this mind of ours has the potential to be absolutely full of what we call the positive qualities, love, kindness, compassion, wisdom, joy, you name them, we have the capability of developing these to a degree that would be absurd almost in our culture, you know. Then you could say that actually that's psychological, but just Buddha is actually being quite radical. That's all. He's being extremely radical in his assertion of what's possible. And he's equally saying, this is because this is part of the deal, that we can be completely free of what we call the suffering qualities, the negative ones, the ones that cause us suffering, the ones that cause us to harm others. And, you know, we don't need God or Buddha or philosophers to tell us when we hear these words, you know, jealousy, anger, fear, depression, anxiety. What Buddha's fundamental point is that every single living being, each one of us, every living being, has the potential innately. It's the very nature of our mind, in fact, to be fully developed in these two wings, to see reality as it is, to see clearly the minds of others and things as they are, the implication of which is our own happiness and joy, and the implication of which is therefore the capacity to be infinitely compassionate and skillful in our ability to benefit others. This is, speaking simply, you know, this is the words that would refer to a person who's done this job, who's developed this potential, a person who's achieved their own Buddhahood, these religious words. But actually we're dealing with the mind. We're dealing with the mind. Buddha doesn't use the term soul, some secret part, not some special part of us, you know, that's untouched by something ordinary. We have, you know, there's one way of talking in the more esoteric teachings of Buddhism, Buddha's Tantra, that they talk about gross level of consciousness, conscious awareness, which is the gross level, the day-to-day sensory, conceptual capacity for awareness that we live in as humans, you know. But this is the tip of the iceberg, according to Buddha. Then we have subtle consciousness, a subtler capacity for awareness. And we virtually never touch that. We get glimpses. We can say we get glimpses, you know, when we have some sensitivity towards others, awareness of others' feelings, intuition, these things. We're just glimpsing the outside, if you like, of this subtler capacity. But that for great meditators, beings who have really in a sophisticated way developed their minds to an extraordinary degree, they've developed this level, and that capacity, that level of the mind, that level of mental capacity, is such that one can see past and future. One can see the minds of others. We can call this metaphysical, but this is a natural progression, Buddha says, in our psychological development. This is what our potential is. And then we can even say there's very subtle consciousness. And there's a term for this that, you know, it's indestructible consciousness. This is the subtlest level of our conscious being, if you like, beyond which it can't be subtler. And this is what Buddha would say is, as I said, indestructible. And this implies that it has never not existed. So in Buddhist terms, there's no concept of creation in the usual religious idea. There's no concept of creation. I didn't get made by somebody. So this is, and so this where we see that in Buddhist view that the idea of what the mind is extremely important to understand it. And one of the things is that it's not physical. Not one atom of my mind, my intellect, emotions, feelings, unconscious, subconscious, spirit, what we would even call soul, if you like, whatever you like, you know. Not one atom of this is non-physical. In normal religious terms, what we call the spirit or the soul is not physical, but in Buddhist terms, the whole deal of your inner being, everything that isn't your body, isn't your eyelashes, isn't your nose, that's your mind and that's not physical. Doesn't get created by Buddha or God or some superior being. Doesn't come from nowhere. It's not some random event. That's an absurd idea. But also, shockingly enough for most of us, we do not come from our parents. Body, not a problem. Egg and sperm come together, you know, and form into this body. But Buddha says the body, the brain, is not the mind. There clearly is a very intimate relationship. That's evident. But is not the mind. The mind is mine. My mind is mine. If I had perfect memory, I could trace my mental moments right back to the first moment of conception. We know that's where it inexorably leads to, goes back to. But Buddha would say you can trace it back to a previous moment before the egg and sperm came together, that very consciousness. You don't trace yourself back to a creator. You don't trace yourself back to your parents. You trace your own consciousness back to previous moments of itself. So clearly, we you know, our parents, the external environment, plays a major role in who we are. But it's not just it's not just semantics, you know. It's a major difference, actually, the Buddhist view, you know. The main cause of who I am is my past, the activities and events within my past, within my consciousness before. And this is the idea of karma. This is the principle. This is the creative principle in Buddhism, if you like. Everything I say, everything I do, everything I think, everything I feel is a seed, like I said before, that is imprinted, implanted in my consciousness, in my continuity of consciousness. And this, like any seed, will ripen at some point as experiences. This is the principle of karma. As I said, in this sense, we can say we are the fruit of what we have done before. So, I mean, philosophically, it's a really interesting idea. We could get extremely interested and study it very deeply and get full marks in our philosophy exam. But none of that's the point. The point of it is the experiential. The point of it is to really get the experiential implications of it. And this is where Buddha talks at a kind of a deeper level about how changing the mind is absolutely fundamental to happiness, to capacity to benefit others, to the development of our potential. And changing the mind isn't something mysterious, you know. It's really changing the way we see things. I mean, it's not a joke to say that Buddha really is a supreme cognitive therapist. This is actually the idea that what we think determines how we feel, determines whether we suffer, and the rest is exactly what Buddha is saying. But may I suggest, my feeling is he goes to much, again, more radical levels. The Buddha says one of the crucial ways we practice as a Buddhist is to learn to know our mind. And that means to know what, when we point here, to the heart, to know our emotions. Because we can clearly see, up here, if you like, here is the mind. We think one and one is two is the mind. But we know somehow, you know, it's not the learning of numbers that causes us happiness or suffering. It's not the learning of simply having, you know, constructing new intelligent ideas. It's our approach to it. It's what we point here, the heart, our emotions, what we call our emotions. Now, what's totally interesting about this and about Buddha's view is we have these, you know, according to Buddha, he's arguing with a series of assumptions that we all seem to have that we simply take to be true, that we accept them unquestioningly. So even if we're religious, even if we do, you know, accept a creator, and that's completely our decision and our choice, I'm not even, you know, not even a discussion about that. Nevertheless, we would all accept absolutely that we're made by our parents, and we must trace back a lot of our suffering or happiness to our parents. Now, in one way, that's not mistaken. Buddha would also agree, because external conditions do play a major role in our lives. It's very obvious. In the same way that, you know, the water and the soil and the sunshine play a crucial role in the growth of that apple tree. But we all know the central cause, the main cause, is the apple seed. You can have the best soil on earth, but if the seed has got problems, it'll never grow properly as an apple tree. So the external conditions, the parents, the external, our education, the external environment do play a major role. But it's like, Buddha's saying, it's like we give the total power, the total cause to those things, as if the sun and the water and the soil are the main cause for there being an apple tree. And we just simply know it's not true. So the main cause of who we are, Buddha says, is not our parents, is not the external environment, is not the Catholic nuns who educated me. You know, the main cause of who we are is the past actions of our own. The word karma is Sanskrit, and it means action, but has this dynamic implication of implying a reaction, that everything we say, do, and think is a karma, an action that brings a reaction, you know, a seed that brings a fruit. So we are the living, walking, talking, thinking, feeling fruits of past seeds, which we planted, which were planted, if you like, by the previous us, you know, and were labelled Fred or Mary or dog or something. But same continuity of consciousness. This is the Buddhist idea. So we could go into more detail about karma, but the real point here is the experiential implication of this, as I said, which is that I'm responsible, not guilty, which is how we hear it, you know, not guilty. There's no concept of sort of blame, victim, oppressor. In Buddhism, there's no concept of sort of, you know, punishment and reward. Somebody out there punishing or rewarding us. So if we think, well, and if we have that as an assumption, and then we think, oh, you mean I'm the person who's the cause and I must be the blame. We have this kind of very strong view, it seems, isn't it? This basically victim mentality that Buddha would say. This sense that, you know, again, you look at one of the assumptions we seem to have, you know, that we don't question. It's kind of cliched, but you check. It's how we feel if we really analyze. That somehow I didn't ask to get born. You know, excuse me, someone plonked me here. I didn't ask to get born. In a sense, saying, what's it got to do with me? You know. So when we really learn to be our own therapists, really learn to practice the Buddha's path, really attempt to practice it, what we are learning to understand is this part of our mind. Because Buddha's saying they are the wrong assumptions, deeply held in the bones of our being, that we need to kind of strip away and to like deconstruct in order to learn to reconstruct, Buddha would say, views about how reality is that are in sync with reality. So, okay, here obviously, you know, this means we need to check up because we might not agree that Buddha is talking about reality. We might think his view of reality is completely wrong. Well, that's fine. That's up to us. We don't have to believe Buddha. But clearly Buddha, when he presents his views of reality, just like Einstein, he is saying, I am right. But he's not saying you have to believe him. That's the point. You know, so Buddha says we have these series of assumptions in our mind, deeply held in the bones of our being, that are completely mistaken, that are out of sync with reality. And as long as we live according to those wrong assumptions, we are always going to suffer. We're going to bump our heads against the wall continuously, you know. So one of these wrong assumptions, Buddha would say, is this one that I didn't, you know, that somehow someone made me, put me here. What's it got to do with me? This is the hand of cards that I was dealt with. What can I do, you know? And you check, that's how we really feel. We know, most interestingly, we know we have a lot of capacity in our culture to develop the intellect, to develop skills, you know, technical skills. But we don't really think we can change our hearts at all. We think, well, I was born with this amount of anger, that amount of love, that amount of generosity, this amount of jealousy, this amount of depression. What to do? We're not really given many techniques. We don't go to courses, you know, how to develop, how to get rid of a depression like this, you know. We just tend to think, this is who I am, this is the way I was made. And so we sort of think we have to make the most of it. But the Buddhist idea is that absolutely we have to make the most of it, but it's not fixed in space. The tendencies are there since the time we were conceived, Buddha says. And we can see this. You look at little children coming out, little tiny things. If we look objectively and use, you know, this psychological view, you can see jealousy, anger, unhappiness, contentment in little babies, you know. Old souls, as we say. Isn't it? We can see. They weren't brand new little things made by those parents. We can see they've got their own tendencies. Some children have tendencies since tiny kids to stamp on snails and hurt them. Other children will cry, you know. Like a friend of mine, her child, when he was three, she was taking the lice out of his head and he cried, "Mommy, Mommy, leave them alone. Don't hurt them. It's their home." She was surprised. She hadn't taught him this. I mean, where'd this come from? He's three. He doesn't read, you know. He can't. It was in his heart. So where'd that come from, you know? Somehow. We can see there's little formed beings right there. So Buddha says all those imprints, the tendencies are there. We bring the tendencies with us. This is the creative principle. So these emotions that we have, we can see the tendency since we're tiny kids. So this, the idea here, the implication of the karmic idea, is that then I can learn to know, if I'm learned to know what I think and feel since a very tiny child, recognize that they're mine, you know, and know, this is the miracle, that I can change. That I can learn to develop even more my love, my kindness, my compassion. It hasn't got a lid on it, you know. Buddha says we can develop it infinitely to degrees that we would think are insane if we heard some of the examples. And that we can get rid of jealousy, anger, fear, depression, which is almost a shocking idea for us. It's kind of interesting. We know when we say those words that they are heartbreaking, that we do not like them, if they're inside us or whether we're on the receiving end. We know they are terrible. Anger, depression, fear, jealousy, anxiety. But at the same time, when we hear that maybe we should try to get rid of them, we feel like defensive, is that we ought to keep them. You know, it's normal, it's human behavior. We'd be abnormal if we didn't have them. So it's a bit schizophrenic, you know, somehow. I mean, one of the arguments we often have is that we need to have anger, we need to have suffering in order to appreciate happiness. Well, I'm sorry, it's a nice theory. So you mean you would like me to punch you first before I'm kind to you? Just so you can appreciate my kindness? I don't think so, you know. We're not stupid. We recognize kindness when we see it. We don't need to refer to that suffering punch to recognize it. Okay, we will appreciate it all the more if we've just been punched. But we don't need to have suffering in order to know happiness. This is just not true. If we analyze our experiences, we can see. So the Buddhist idea, it's two things here actually. The Buddhist idea is we do have the potential. And why is because Buddha says nothing's permanent. Nothing's fixed in space. Nothing can't be changed. There's nothing that can't be changed. It's the very nature, in fact. I mean, one of Buddha's main tenets, you know, that again is used not as some interesting philosophical concept, but is really thought about deeply and meditated upon until we get some experience of it, is that everything that comes together in dependence upon causes and conditions is necessarily impermanent. It's in a state of flux. So the mind, more than anything, is that. Things shift and change and move. So it's the terrible irony of ego, which is what Buddha says is the root of our problems, this fundamental, primordial misconception locked into the bones of our being, about our own concrete I, is the one that limits us completely, you know, completely limits us and paralyzes us. We are convinced that this is who I am, this is the way I was made, what can I do about it? No wonder we get depressed. I mean, no wonder we get anxious, you know, because there's this awful sense of hopelessness sometimes. It's the irony of ego, you know. One of the starting points for a person attempting to practice Buddhism is to listen to, you know, Buddha's ideas and then to try to internalize it, to see the truth of it. That there's nothing that can't be changed. There's nothing that can't be changed. Everything is a question of practice, and this is where this cognitive idea, cognitive therapy comes in. It's a question of, you know, changing the way we see things, and there's nothing in us that can't be changed. I mean, it's an extremely liberating idea, you know. So as long as we have the assumption that I'm stuck, this is who I am, of course it's hopeless. Of course, and it's very painful to want to take responsibility for what's inside there. Because if we don't have much sense that we can change it, it's best to leave it alone and pretend it's not there, isn't it? Or to blame other people for it, which is what we do, you know. But if we do have some kind of comprehension from listening and thinking and contemplating these things, that I am not fixed in space, no matter how garbage my mind is, no matter how difficult things are, I can learn to change. I mean, it's a really simple idea, but quite profound. Then there's great courage. And then there's much more courage to persevere through the obstacles, but also more courage to see what is there. Of course I don't want to look at my anger if I'm convinced I can't change it. It's much easier to blame somebody else. Or to internalize it and be completely depressed, you know, which is just internalized anger. Buddha says we have this, that, you know, if we analyze this, we can see the truth of it. Forget even about karma, you know. Don't think about past lives even. If we observe our mind, observe our experiences, we can see it as logical that they change. Therefore, I can take control of it, not be dragged along by the nose. I can make decisions about how to change. I'm the boss of my life, you know. I mean, we all say we want to be happy. We all know we have things like anxiety and fear and depression and jealousy, attachment, anger. We all know these words. We recognize them immediately. And we all know they are extremely painful. But somehow, this is the tragedy too. This is the one of this view of putting it onto others, you know, this view that this is how I am, or clearly the view too, especially the view that we have, again, deep in the bones of our being, which Buddha is fundamentally debating with, is that, you know, that the outside things are the source of my happiness and suffering. This is a view we absolutely all accept, without question. It appears this way, it feels this way, it smells this way, it looks this way. That the outside is the source of my happiness, the outside is the source of my suffering. And this is where it is most interesting, really investigating our minds psychologically, investigating the emotions, where we start to see one aspect of these emotions. And that is the aspect of the emotions is indicated by the term delusion. Delusion. What Buddha is saying is there are two characteristics, actually, to our unhappy states of mind. These two characteristics are exactly what the happy states, the positive states of mind are free of. So the unhappy states of mind, that's the suffering ones or the negative ones, also called delusions, have the two characteristics, and one of them is really evident, and that is that this is a term in Tibetan, a translation of a term which is a synonym for negative state of mind, unhappy state of mind, delusion. It is disturbing emotion. It's really clear it's disturbing to me. Don't worry about anybody else. When anger's in my mind, when jealousy is there, when anxiety is there, it is disturbing. I am disturbed, and that's called unhappy. It's very simple. Now, already what blocks us from really seeing this and learning deeply from it, because we all know we don't want suffering. So to really, what blocks us from really owning responsibility for that and seeing it, that it's causing me suffering, is our absolute belief that I'm depressed because that happened, and I'm angry because she did this, and I'm jealous because he did that, you know. So we see the cause on the outside. So we know it's painful, but it almost seems outrageous that I should stop my anger. Excuse me, what do you mean? You should stop what you're doing. I'm allowed to be angry. I am right to be angry, we think. So we know it's painful. But we have this view, this philosophical view, that yes, it's painful, but you did it. Therefore, you know, you should change. So we're kind of paralyzing ourselves, blocking ourselves up, you know. It's almost like I've just eaten some poison and it's causing me suffering. It's like the anger is causing me suffering, okay? And I've eaten some poison and it's going to bring more suffering. But then I say, excuse me, you put the poison in my food, it's your fault. But every day I'm getting more miserable, more sick, you know. But it's your fault, why should I change? I mean, it's demented, right? I'm suffering. It doesn't matter who did it to me. So it's sort of simple. We know these words. Buddha didn't invent this, you know. We know these things. But this is the very heart of Buddha's practice. And thinking and thinking and thinking about this, meditating on it, it brings some strong conviction, some strong confidence that yes, indeed, what people do to me in the world indeed is extremely suffering. The world does appalling things to each other. There's no question, you know. But if I really know that I have the power to change my response to it, then already so liberating, unbelievable. So this attitude we have that the outside is the source of our suffering, the outside is the source of our happiness, is actually completely, it's like giving our power to everything else. And it's the blame mentality. It's the blame mentality. I blame you. I point to you as the source of my suffering. But it's really the same when things make me happy. I point to the chocolate cake and it's like I'm blaming the chocolate cake for making me happy. I give the responsibility to the cake, you know. What can I do? Look at it, so delicious. Vibrating deliciousness at me, demanding that I eat it, you know. What can I do? This is how we think, isn't it? What can I do? You punch me, of course I'm going to get angry. What do you mean not get angry? Don't be ridiculous, you know. It's impossible. That's how we think, right? We're like complete victims to the punch or to the chocolate cake. So having this changing slowly, you know, this view, that I can change my view. That actually, this is what Buddha is saying, when we really start to investigate the anger that blames, the attachment that grasps, we start to see it has this characteristic, one, of being disturbing, which is unhappiness, suffering, but two, indicated by the term delusion, it's a liar. That in reality, this attachment in my mind is what literally makes up the story delicious chocolate cake. We think right now with these views that the cake innately is delicious. The deliciousness is somehow in the cake, as if you put a spoonful of it in when you put the chocolate and the eggs in, right? That somehow, isn't it? It looks delicious out there, doesn't it? It's totally fascinating, this. And Buddha's saying that's because of unbelievable, enormous habit of projecting onto the outside, that the very energy of attachment is such that it has the function of literally inventing, making the cake look delicious to my eyes. And then we grasp at it, thinking we need it, you know, having expectation that it will bring me happiness. And then being upset when it doesn't come. Attachment, actually, Buddha says, is almost the default mode of our mind. It's the one that is completely at the source, you know, of our suffering, the day-to-day. It's like a motor that propels us from moment to moment, you know, so deeply ingrained in our minds. That it is an emotion, definitely. But the emotion part is just the gross level. That's because we've thought these thoughts. We've made up this conceptual construction, this story in the mind that invents delicious chocolate cake, gorgeous person, lovely this, beautiful that. Our mind has made it up. Not just instantly. The habit of it is there, you know. Not just now. It's there from habit. Ancient habit. And so anything we've done that often, it affects the energy of the body. So all the things happen, you know. When you get angry, same thing. Anger, we definitely think of as an emotion. And it is. It's got that component. But that's the grossest level of it. But when we begin to investigate our mind through much meditation, using these sophisticated psychological techniques called meditation, which is what they are, we begin to become extremely familiar with the workings of our mind well before it vomits out the mouth, which is usually the only time we know we're angry, you know? The only time we know we're depressed, when we can't get ourselves out of bed one morning. But the thoughts that are behind the emotion, the bare bones of the emotion, have been there a long, long time. And they're all working away, but because we're not familiar with our minds, we haven't got skills to really hear the subtle story going on underneath. We only notice it when it comes to the surface. When we start to look into our minds, be our own therapists in this way, we really can see the mind clearly, really can see. And it's like it's going speeding very, very fast. So we learn to be able to analyze it, break it down, you know, distinguish between the various. It's like one big soup in there right now, all the thoughts and feelings and emotions, like not just a regular soup, but a pureed soup, completely merged together, you know, impossible to distinguish. But it is possible. We have to look. And that's the skill we have to learn, you know. And then we can start to have more power. Then we can see that really delicious chocolate cake is an invention of our mind. Not just the first day. I mean, Lama Yeshe says, I can tell you about attachment for one whole year. We will never begin to understand it. It's extremely subtle, actually. So the really interesting function of these unhappy states of mind, one is clearly that they're disturbing, which is the suffering. But two is that they're liars. They're liars. They lead us up garden paths, you know. In other words, this is exactly what I was saying before, that Buddha is saying the extent to which we're not in sync with reality, which is exactly the function of these unhappy emotions, is the extent to which we suffer. Because we follow, you know, as long as we think the cake is that delicious thing, and as long as we believe it will make me happy when I get it, as long as we give it all this power that it really doesn't possess, as long as we have all these massive expectations, all this neediness, which is the energy of attachment, then we are absolutely guaranteed to suffer. Guaranteed. We're setting ourselves up for disaster every time. Attachment is pervasive, you know. It's not just some people have a suffering of attachment. And again, that's the view in our culture in general. That someone who's an addict, you know, we use the word addiction. But it's, in Buddhist terms, it's a synonym for attachment. Really, truly. So we think an addict is a person who, you know, is addicted to heroin, addicted to alcohol, addicted to cigarettes. We usually define the addiction by the unhappy object, you know. But Buddha says, excuse me, we're all addicts. Truly, it's just a question of degree, that's all. And the name of addiction is attachment, desire, addiction. And Buddha's psychology, as I'm saying, you know, has very precise, clear ways of describing how it functions. And this is what we use as a basis for our meditation, to investigate our minds. Not just to believe that attachment is wrong, which is the guilty way we tend to be. Oh, I shouldn't be attached. Nonsense. We need to understand why. That we have to investigate it, to see for ourselves. And then no one can convince. Then no one needs to convince us of anything. We know ourselves. Then, you know, attachment's a liar. Anger is a liar. Jealousy is a liar. They're elaborate conceptual constructions that our mind makes up. Buddha's not joking when he says this. You know, it's subtle. It's hard to see. But this is why we need to learn these skills to look. And they're called meditation. Again, don't mystify them, really. They're very practical techniques. They're not religious. A communist could meditate, you know. It's not religious. It's not holy. It's extremely difficult to focus and sharpen the mind in order to see what's going on inside, you know, which is what we need to do. I mean, if we can't know our own minds, that's a bit insane, isn't it? I mean, who can, you know? I mean, the way it is in our culture, we don't really have methods that we're brought up with. We're supposed to just make the most of it and be a good person. And then when we completely can't handle it, we have people called therapists whom we go to. Okay, that's great. Aren't we lucky? We're very fortunate. But the very fact that we need to have an expert who knows about the mind, you know? But it's my mind. If I can't know about my mind, it's astonishing. So we first have to want to do it. We have to see there's a logical reason, not a guilty reason. If we feel there's some space there to be more content, less neurotic, less jealous, less angry, less depressed, more in control of our mind, more kind, more loving, if we do feel there's some space, then there's work to do, you know. And all Buddha's saying is it's possible. It's doable. It's not mysterious, it's not metaphysical. It's hard work, it's the hardest job we'll ever do. But then it makes everything worthwhile. Whether you want to become a millionaire, a footballer, a mother, you'll do every job better. If you want to benefit others, you'll do that better. This is the Buddhist approach. Did I do my job yet or not? No, it's a bit early. Unless there's any burning questions. No, maybe I'll say some more. Let me say a bit more about these two wings again, you know. This wisdom wing, which is what I've been talking about up until now, roughly speaking, is where you really learn to become very familiar with this whole concept of karma as a very experiential, you know, thing, not just interesting philosophy, and really learn to shift the mind, to take more responsibility, to be more empowered, actually. Then to learn to know in the more sophisticated way the workings of the mind, really precisely, really clearly, slowly kind of unraveling the complexities of these emotions of ours. And to whatever extent we're capable of doing this, to this extent we can benefit others by practicing the compassion wing, you know. So you could say the work on the wisdom wing, the direct beneficiary of that is yourself. Now don't for a second think that's not spiritual. We often get guilty and think, well, that isn't spiritual. That's me. It's self-centered, you know. Absolute nonsense. If I cannot develop my own mind, if I don't know why I'm suffering, if I can't understand my human condition, how can I possibly understand yours? Impossible. If I can't play the piano, how can I teach you to play piano? So compassion is the ability, we would define in Buddhist psychology that compassion is the wish that you don't suffer. It's the empathy with the suffering of another. So unless I have that for myself, okay, they don't use that word in Buddhism, they would say we need to develop what we call renunciation, which sounds rather forbidding, but it really is this idea of compassion for yourself. This is coming from the wisdom wing. You have to know from investigation what the potential of your own mind is, what you're capable of, what the suffering states of mind are, what the positive ones are, distinguish them, and learn to begin to have some control over the whole process. Then I'm qualified to see another person, to help another person, because we're all basically just, you know, variations on the theme, really. So the direct beneficiary of compassion is others. All the work on the compassion wing is directly to benefit others. But it's based on the assumption of some work that you've done on yourself. And most crucial, it's based on the idea of the understanding of your own suffering. So what's suffering? I mean, this is an awful word, you know. Buddha has a very interesting view towards suffering. There's one like package of suffering. You know, we can talk about the ordinary, the first level, there's three of them. First kind is ordinary, everyday, in-your-face suffering, you know, which we all agree with. Aches and pains and miserable and people leaving us and like that, you know. Then there's a subtler level of suffering, which we wouldn't even call suffering, which is a bit scary. We actually call it happiness. And that's what we get when we follow attachment. So this is where Buddha would say that attachment is this really deceptive, appalling state of mind. So don't, for one second, confuse it with positive states of mind. I mean, we use that word virtually interchangeably now, I think, don't we? You know, attachment with attachment, love, pleasure. In Buddhist terms, love is the wish that others be happy. It's necessarily altruistic. It's got nothing to do with attachment. But as far as we're concerned, attachment, the way Buddha understands it, only for us comes with love. We usually only attach to people we love. And we usually only love people we're attached to. So it's like we can be forgiven for thinking they're virtually the same thing. But in Buddhist terms, they're completely different. One is deceptive. It's completely neurotic. It's dependent in the neurotic way. It's fearful. It's lonely. It's needy. It has all these massive expectations. It's not accurate in its assessment of the object, the person. It lives in a fantasy land. And it's the source of so much pain. Its energy is neediness. And why do you think you need something? Because you think you lack it. Whereas love, you know, actually attachment, which is the disease we all have, this addiction we all have, and you know, attachment to is endless in its capability of creating objects to grasp onto, to project onto, you know. Attachment love is the wish that others be happy. Compassion is may you not suffer. Love is may you be happy. It's absolutely different from attachment. Attachment is I-based in a neurotic sense. It's fearful, it's lonely, it's needy, it's anxious. It manipulates, it expects. It's scary, you know, actually. It's completely giving all the power to the outside and saying that I'm nothing. It's a symptom of a very suffering person, basically, which is all of us. We're all in the same boat. Love is a symptom of health, mental health. It's interdependent. It's connected to the other person. It's spacious. The heart is reaching out. There's a big sense of we. When there's attachment, there's a little lonely I over here, desperate to get that thing into me, you know, to fill me up. Whereas love is spacious, is connected to others, is healthy, and interestingly, isn't disturbing, isn't inaccurate, isn't deluded. It's in touch with how things exist. So these are the so-called positive qualities, not in a judgmental sense, but simply if we recognize that part of ourself and that can be more prevalent, that is when we're happy. And that is when we can make others happy. When attachment is more prevalent, that is when we suffer. And that's when we inevitably cause others to suffer. But of course, when it's mixed with love, it's really sneaky. We can't see it. We don't do it on purpose. It's just we're not familiar, that's all, with how these things work. Certainly not using Buddha's views anyway, when he's very precise in his assessment of these two. For example, the differences, you know. And so if it is true, which is what Buddha's saying, that our suffering comes from attachment, if it is true, then we need to investigate it, obviously. We need to be able to recognize it. But half the time when we become, you know, let's say become religious or Buddhist or whatever, we sort of chuck the baby out with the bathwater and think we've got to become detached and stop loving people. And, you know, we become kind of become rather fundamentalist, you know. So we're either hedonists or fundamentalists. Completely extreme. So it's really kind of very precise and very refined, the awareness that we need to develop in order to really distinguish between these two. And this is just an example. Love is, so when we practice the compassion wing, it's when we actively do, and there's many, many, many meditations that we are taught in this tradition that go step by step, you know. Many, many, many ways of changing the way we see things, which is what the practice is. Shifting our mind. Opening our mind, expanding our mind, quite literally to encompass others, you know. So, as I said, the direct beneficiary of the compassion wing is others. The reference point is others. But the indirect beneficiary, obviously, is yourself. And the direct beneficiary of the wisdom wing is self. But obviously, the indirect beneficiary is others. And so the very first level of practice is the wisdom wing, where you learn to really, the very basic level, observing that you don't want more suffering, you attempt to refrain from creating the causes for it. So you refrain from being angry, you refrain from lying, you refrain from being to be too much attached, so on and so forth. You kind of watch your body and watch your speech and protect your mind from creating negativity. And the reason is because you do not want further suffering. We're not even discussing compassion yet. It's like compassion for yourself. If we in this world really realized that anger and depression, for example, are what cause us to suffer, who in their right mind would ever be angry for 1 second if we realized it? So it shows how removed we are from something so fundamental, you know. It's like we're stabbing ourselves every day and we keep blaming the knife. So it's quite profound to realize that anger and jealousy and pride cause us suffering. Me, you know. I remember in a prison in Kentucky where I go once a year to see some people, and some of them are on death row. And one of them was telling me recently about an old guy, some old man, Catholic, who'd been visiting the prisoners. Extremely compassionate. But 20 years ago or 30 years ago, I can't remember, he was, and he told them about this, his daughter had been murdered. And so for the first 20 years, he was out of his mind with rage, absolutely full of vindictiveness, raging. And he said himself that slowly it dawned on him, after 20 years of intense suffering, that he was suffering because of his own rage. Yes, his daughter had been murdered, but he really realized his own rage was the cause of his suffering, not the person who killed his daughter. So he was so fortunate. He made this profound shift, a paradigm shift in his mind, you know. Now he spends his time visiting the guys on death row, you know, helping them. This is the one, I tell you, it's unbelievable. We're not even discussing compassion for others yet. If we could just slowly realize, without guilt, without shame, but with wisdom, recognize that our own depression, our jealousy, our anxiety, our fears, are the source of our pain, and that there, and that we can change them, and that we can change them, and that we can change them, you know. To even start with that kind of confidence is already unbelievable. Everything in our life would be different if we had that kind of confidence. But we have to not just believe it, we have to see, look at it, look into it, see the logic of it, you know. And then slowly, slowly, step by step, tiny increment by increment, do that job. We say, we know, practice makes perfect. We know that really well. Well, there's one Lama, Bhavanka Rinpoche, he says, nothing gets difficult with familiarity. It's almost a simple idea, but so profound, you know. If we have the courage to see it. And actually it does take huge courage, because somehow the irony of attachment and all these delusions is that it's almost like we're stuck in a comfort zone, you know. We know we're suffering, but we believe we can't change, but actually it's scary, the thought of changing. It's almost like we'd rather be here, you know. We're familiar with it. Because it's painful. Just like anything when you change. If you're fat and overweight and your muscles are all floppy and someone says, well, you know, going to the gym and doing push-ups will do you really good and you'll get really fit and gorgeous, you know. So you run off to the gym and you start doing them. But you end up feeling a lot worse, don't you? The blood is rising and you're puffing and panting and aches and pains everywhere. And I mean, we know no way do we like that pain. So we mostly give up, you know. Oh, it didn't make any difference. I tried the gym. It didn't work, you know. I got lots of pain. So when we understand that that's an inevitable part of the process, and actually it's a good sign, then we'll have courage to persevere, because we have a vision of what the potential is at the end. Well, that's how it is with changing our emotions. They're extremely stuck in their ways, you know. It's terrifying to change depression, to change anger. No, I mean, no wonder we believe it's not possible. So you have to have great courage, you know. Really have to have great courage to know it's possible, to want to do it, to see the benefits to myself, not to mention others, and then slowly, slowly to persevere. And to persevere in the pain, because, you know, we're going along now feeling reasonably comfortable like we were before we went to the gym, and now it's like everything's thrown up, it's complete chaos. There's pain, your body's hurting, you're puffing and panting, you've got to get up early, it's difficult, you've got to really commit, you know. And that's the difficulty. And that's why they say, you know, the lamas would say that if you know the benefits of something, then you don't need to be convinced to do it. So we have to first think of the benefits, not just do it because it looks kind of nice, you know. Oh, someone says going to the gym is a good idea. Got to be prepared to work hard at it. There's no question when we start to look at our mind, it becomes extremely difficult. Even they say when you start to learn to do even simple meditation techniques, you think your mind's getting worse. It's not. We're just noticing it for the first time. Or as Lama Zopa Rinpoche said, you know, the dirt has to come out. So we've got to be brave, you know, to do this job. We've got to see intelligently what it's about, understand how to interpret the process as you go along, which is why it's important to have a teacher, a spiritual community. And then just keep moving, one step at a time, never giving up. No choice, you know. In fact, when Buddha talks a lot about we've got this Buddha nature, meaning this potential for perfection, basically. That the logical extension of the small amount of love we have now is to be fully developed love for all beings without exception. You can't go anywhere but there, you know. You have to follow it through logically. Then when we realize that we don't have a choice, almost when we realize this, we realize we don't have a choice. Why, you know, if an acorn can become an oak tree, how foolish to put a cap on it? How foolish to try and stop it from growing more? Oh, well, you know, half an oak tree will do. If it's got the potential to grow to a huge oak tree, please let it do so. It's its nature. It's the nature of that acorn. You don't have a choice, you know. You can't make it a pear tree. So how foolish not to allow it to become what it really is. This is the idea here. What Buddha's saying is what we really are is a Buddha. We're not it yet. An acorn isn't an oak tree yet. You'll be disappointed if you try to get shade from it. But it's like it is. It's so tasty. You might as well say. And if, especially if for so long you've just thought an acorn was this boring little brown thing, you know, all those little boring brown things messing up my garden. And then one day you discover that it can become that magnificent thing. Then you see it very differently. Well, this is the view that Buddha says we have right now, extremely limited view of who we think we are. Like, you know, you decide that an acorn is a nice little thing, so you polish it up every day and look at it and think, isn't it cute, and all the rest, and get very attached to the little brown thing. But realize that actually what it is this amazing tree. Well, it's like us, and we're kind of trying to polish up this little thing, but we're so limited. Or we think it's horrible and kick it around, you know. We have no choice, Buddha says, when we start to understand the nature of mind. Mind in its nature. Buddha didn't invent this. We weren't made this way. It is simply who we are. An acorn is simply a potential oak tree. No choice. We are simply a potential Buddha, he's saying, you know. Which means, psychologically, the development of what we call all the things we already have within us now. They're in us now. Love, kindness, patience, generosity, you name it. They are our natural state, Buddha says. You don't have to find them and inject them into you, you know. They are already who you are. You don't inject oak tree-ness into an acorn. You give it the appropriate conditions that allow it to manifest. Well, that's it. We need to find the conditions that will allow our own true nature to manifest. Hear it in a practical way. For whose benefit? My own and others. And how foolish not to do this, you know. How foolish to stay limited, miserable, depressed, blame other people, anxious. It's insane, you know. I don't know, what else? You can better ask me some questions now. If you would like to. Someone's got the job.
So the plan is, the revised plan. The initial plan was that you would write questions on a piece of paper and pass them up, but that seemed to dislocate us too much. We want to know who is asking the question and hear it in your own voice. So the plan is we'll have the microphone here and you can just make a line and come up and ask questions as you please. And I was asked to ask the first question, to get things rolling. So, my question is, we're living in a time of what seems to be vast social unrest. And as an activist, which I consider you still to be, I'm wondering about how the process of changing one's mind and heart is applicable to the effectiveness of social activism.
Well, that's the one, you know. There's absolutely not a fraction of contradiction. This idea of the two wings of the bird, the compassion wing is activism, you know. But I think if I compare the activism of being a Buddhist, or my attempt at being a Buddhist activist, it's in one way exactly the same as when I was an activist before, when I attempted to be for eight, nine years, when I was sort of a bit of an old lefty and tried to bash the world into shape, you know. Then, I mean, I could see there was injustice. I could see there was sexism, racism, and thisism, and whatever. There was suffering. There was no doubt. Since I was a kid, it was clear to me, you know, and I always wanted to find why, to find solutions, you know. It just occurred to me that way. And so that manifested when from the age of maybe 21 or something until about 31, in, you know, being a bit of a lefty and all that. So somehow the same, exactly the same now, I can see the suffering. And I want to change it. Without sounding too noble, you know. It seems to make sense. It's sort of logical. But the difference is in the interpretation of the causes of it and therefore the methods that you use to solve it. That's all. It's the difference. It's just different methodology. So the methods that I attempted to use then was the view that it was coming, if you like, coming from this very cathartic experience of anger, which is the view, in Buddhist terms, the mistaken view that all the blame is out there. And so then I would have compassion, for example, you know, for a person who was poor. But usually it was the extent to which I would then have anger towards the rich. And then when I had compassion for people who, say, for example, black people, that was the extent to which I hated white people. Then I had compassion for female people. And then to that extent, I hated male people. So somehow I started to realize by the time I'd gone through this that there was no one left to hate. There was no one left to blame, you know. So there is truth. It is very obvious. If you see one person hitting another person, it's not wrong to say that person is wrong to hit that person. That is a fact. But, you know, the Buddhist view, which is the one I happen to be attempting to live according to, Buddha's philosophical presentation of why that is happening. And I think this is an incredibly important thing, because we all have this question, why is it happening? Why me? And often when we can't get past that question is when we go crazy, is when we have so much fear and so much anguish and so much anger. Then somehow we need to ask that question. So it happens to be, for me now, I ascribe to Buddha's views. They allow me to have much more sanity, much more clarity, less blame, less anger, less confusion, less fear, increased kindness, increased compassion, therefore, logically, increased capability to act. Because action, finally, is the point. The Bodhisattva, the compassion wing, is actually not just, oh my goodness, look at the suffering of others. It actually is completely centered in this very unique characteristic of the compassion of the compassion wing of practice, as His Holiness the Dalai Lama calls it, universal responsibility. And they call it simply great compassion. So it's like compassion when you begin to develop it, and this is just from, you know, much practice, growing, is the empathy with the suffering of others. But then you've got the next level, which is the crucial one, which is that it's my job to take it away. Now that's activism. So it's like the compassion of the mother for her child. She's on the beach and the kid's drowning, you know. Unbelievable compassion. Unbearable, the thought of that suffering. But she doesn't look around saying, well, who's going to save my kid? She's in that water in one split second because she knows it's her job. There's no doubt. Well, that's the compassion of the Bodhisattva. They're like fanatic, you know. They're like fanatic in their wish to benefit others. And, you know, the Buddhist view is you go from life to life to life to life, developing, constantly expanding your consciousness, lessening the delusions to the point where you've gone beyond ego completely. Increasing this enormous empathy for others to the point where, as if each one is your precious child. So there's that level of responsibility. So that demands unceasing action. Bodhisattvas, as the Dalai Lama says, think in terms of eons. And that means they're well beyond needing a boring old body again, but they spontaneously take countless bodies in order to benefit others, you know. That's the big kind of, okay, high religious idea. But if you bring that down to earth, that's called activism. That's helping others. So the crucial point of it is your motivation, the wish to benefit others. But it's absolutely, and this is the key point, and I can see in my own life I meant really well, but I lacked this one completely, which is wisdom. So compassion is the wish to benefit others, the wish they don't suffer. But that isn't what makes you benefit others. That's not what makes you be an activist. Wisdom is what gives you that capacity, and wisdom is the ability to know what to do when, based on the correct assessment of the causes of the problem. So if you always think that pollution is this and this and this, and you're continually working away trying to remove the pollution, and you've got the wrong solution, you will never get rid of the pollution. You mean really well. You want a free water of pollution, but you've got to have exact, precise comprehension, don't you, of the causes of pollution. Then you can do it easily. So wisdom is the crucial point. And you can only have wisdom when you've gone beyond ego, because it's the presence of the delusions in our mind that blind us from seeing reality. This is Buddha's point. So as I get rid of delusions, so I develop wisdom, so I see more clearly what is how is where is why, then when I develop the compassion wing, spontaneously, effortlessly, one can act, you know, and be effective. This is the point. So in putting it in ordinary political terms, same, there's no contradiction. Look at the Tibetans in Tibet these days who still continue, you know, who did. I remember in 1987, you know, the first uprising since 59, basically. And they were mostly the monks and nuns up there demonstrating, you know, getting killed, getting tortured again. So one of my friends is very interesting. This is the difference. That's what we call political activism. You know, we tend to think, being a Buddhist, you sit there watching your navel, you know, and you've got all this compassion, you're all lovey-dovey, California, huggy-feely, you know. That's not compassion. That's just wishy-washy attachment rubbish. Attachment is extremely powerful, you know. So there's this one of my friends, this monk, okay? I think he lives in San Francisco now. He said, he was telling me about the suffering. He'd demonstrated, he got tortured, his friend got his head blown off. Then his mother, when he escaped, his father got murdered, his brother got murdered, right? And I said to him, he looked very sad, and I said, do you ever get angry? which is what we always can, you know, associate with demonstrations, political activism. We, in fact, can't even imagine you can be politically active unless you have anger. He looked at me very puzzled and he said, angry? What for? And his answer would shock us, but all he meant was karma. But he said it in a very simple way. He said it's our own fault. So this takes time to think about, actually. It's not the one of guilt or whatever, but it's simply Buddha's assessment of the causes of something, that due to past actions, you're now in a situation where you get it back. Good or bad, it's the same cause of why we're human beings sitting here with good lives and good family and leisure and money and love and respect, because we've worked extraordinarily hard in the past. So what we are is a fruit of what we've done, good or bad. So when we recognize that, the Buddha's view is there's no blame, there's no anger, there's no resentment, there's no fear. Truly, they're gone, you know, because you've made these paradigm shifts in your mind. But you still can see injustice, and you know it is inappropriate. You know why it's happening. But then you're happy to go out and demonstrate. You're happy to go out there and never give up trying to make the world a better place. Absolutely appropriate. But it's coming from a very clear, clean place. It's coming from I remember watching a marvelous documentary about the whole shift that happened in that country. What's the country of Milosevic? What was that? Where was that? Yugoslavia? Serbia. Okay. I mean, it was a marvelous documentary about the complete shift that happened in the government. I think it was Milosevic. There's a bunch of young students. Did you see that? Have you seen that, Nina? No. Is that Nina?
Yes, it is.
Okay. It's an extraordinary... These young students, I think a lot of them actually were like... What's... I'm not trying to be naive now. But what? I'm sorry, forgive me. What do they say? You do? What's the word they use for your art? Thank you very much. Performance art, right? These young people, very funny. You could feel light. They were not angry. They never used negative methods. They used amazing, outrageous, wonderful, creative performance methods, I tell you, to completely change. The whole country rallied behind them. One person or something was killed in the whole shift. Not one. There was no violence, but there was demonstrations, unbelievable energy. The whole country came behind it, you know. And it was not angry. It was amazing to see. It was a remarkable film, actually. It's possible, you know. This is the point. I don't know if that answered it. Okay, please talk. Go on then.
Talking about karma, I've practiced meditation and loved the Dharma for 20 years. Now as I begin to study and read the suttas from the original time, I find sexism and it threatens my... It brings up doubt.
I understand.
I just wonder if you could speak
to
that.
I understand. Absolutely, I can. I mean, I'll do my best. Well, before I met the lamas, before I sort of bumped into my spiritual path, I was on the sort of the far outer edge of feminism, where basically I didn't... men were the cause of all suffering. it was my philosophy, truly. I was always, you know, completely 100% clear logical reasons. And I had nothing to do with men except to punch them, basically. And that's a fact. I really mean it. If they disturbed me in the street, I'd punch them in the nose or wherever, you know. And so for me, it came to the point, like I said, that I really could see that it was insane to keep hating the whole human race. It was not the way to go. Somehow it was the fault in that, you know. I could see it wasn't benefiting me at all. So this is when I began to start wanting a spiritual path again. And I started at the time looking into women's spirituality, went back to mass for a while, did this, did that, did TM, and then I bumped into Lama Yeshe in Australia, actually. And the timing was perfect for me because my mind was completely ready for it, my heart was open, you know, whatever. And so, but it was extremely painful also because there I was with my Buddhist, my feminist assumptions. And so there I know the first course I went to of Lama Yeshe, was in 76, all these men around, all these who called women ladies, and all the ladies who couldn't lift the buckets of water. I mean, I was like in outrage most of the time, because I couldn't stand being around all these wimpy hippies, you know. It was just awful for my mind. And then hearing these Buddhist things, and even just saying the word he and the usual kind of talk, it was very painful for me. And then hearing, especially some of the things that you're talking about, you know, that it's inferior to be a female, it's better to be a male, and so on and so forth. So I knew from the very beginning that I'd spent my life always putting the blame on the outside. I'd spent my life being extremely active, extremely kind of aggressive. Well, there's a good side to that. But I knew what I had to do, because I knew part of me, it was so strong, as you said, loving the Dharma, you know, so strongly it was clear to me this was the view that in a sense was in my own view, and I'd like found it again after, you know, I'd lost it and I'd found it again. It was extremely strong for me. So I knew in part of me that it was absolutely the path that I wanted. There was no doubt in my mind. So then I knew I had no choice but to analyze. This is what Buddha was demanding. I had to analyze exactly where all this was coming from. Analyze exactly what Buddha was saying. What is the mind? What is consciousness? What is enlightenment? What is male? What is female? What is karma? Before I could make, you know, decide definitively that it was wrong. So this is how come I'm here now, 26 years later. Because the way I understand it's like this, you know. Well, first of all, even if we just look at the mind, first of all, what's mind? Consciousness. Buddha says it's beginningless. Buddha says my consciousness is existed since beginningless time. It's the only option you can come up with if you don't have creator and you don't have mother, father, and don't have just merely big bangs, you know. As the Dalai Lama said, big bang, no problem, and it's not the first one, that's all. So if you, this is really the only, the philosophically the only logical conclusion you can come to. Maybe no time to talk about that now. But if my consciousness is beginningless, then it does logically assume that I've been male, female, rat, dog, up, down, giraffe, you name it, since beginningless time, which is what Buddha's saying. Because of the view of emptiness, nothing has an inherent nature. There's no inherent male, there's no inherent female, there's no inherent anything. So then, due to the principle of karma, which is created by every single one of us collectively, we are the creators of who we are. So if we're the creators of who we are, we collectively have created male, created female. It's simply a karmic expression of certain energies. And so if I'm female in this life, then I've, you know, I've been male in another life. So what's the real Rabina? So even though at a real, so then I looked at that's the ultimate level. Therefore, ultimately, this mind of mine has the pure nature of anybody's mind, so it has the potential to become perfect. Therefore, male, female is not the point. Mind is mind. It's not male. It's not female. It's not good. It's not bad. It's not animal. It's not anything. It's not human, you know. Consciousness is beyond all of those. These forms we take are merely expressions of certain energies. So if it is so, then in a certain culture, which has happened to be where Buddhism grew up, called India, where they, you know, where they chucked the wife on the funeral pyre of the dead husband, she was alive. Okay, that's clearly not very appropriate. So we, you know, then clearly whatever, how Buddhism developed out of that and developed mostly in Asian countries where, you know, there's usually this patriarchal view, you know, we can see. Then to understand that even in terms of karma, so if I have to think of it personally, if I'm born in a certain shape and a certain form that is considered inferior, then I have, from the karmic point of view, I have to look at that and what does that mean? Don't worry about the politics. What does it mean for me? Forget about the labels male, female. If I'm meeting people who see me as less than I am, that is the direct result of my having abused them, harmed them, used my power inappropriately to harm them in the past. So now this is the karmic result. Now if it happens to be labeled female, then it you know, that's almost like incidental in a way. So for me, it was the personal one that I had to take responsibility for, you know. And so if Buddha says something like, at a certain time in India, it's better to be a male, don't take it personally. It simply means at that particular time, he's absolutely right. If you'd gone off on your own to meditate in a mountain, you'd been shot by a bandit and raped very happily, you know. Or you'd been, you know, chucked on somebody's funeral pyre. It would have been an inappropriate action. I mean, look at certain countries. So if... with great respect, I'm not trying to criticize Muslim views, for example, but in certain countries called Muslim, it is considered inappropriate for a female to show her body. Now, that person is a person who's got a consciousness. She's been a male or a female before. She's born in a situation where it's considered inferior, where this woman recently is going to get killed because she, you know, had a baby from another person. I mean, this is karma, you know. So the view of karma for me was the key thing to it that really helped me take responsibility and go beyond this kind of... yeah, not taking it personally. Seeing that if I am born in a situation that's labelled a certain thing, called female, and if it is called suffering, then that's mine. It's coming back to me, you know. Somehow it's like, so it's actually quite liberating. It doesn't mean that definitively, innately, a male is superior to a female. This means it's a contextual thing. It's historical, because karma is just contextual. Karma is just convention. It's just agreement. We've all agreed between each other collectively that male is this and female is that. We've all done it, you know. So I often think of them I noticed Tibetan nuns sometimes when I was in Tibet looked like they were really pretty low, you know. The monks had all the power, the monks did this and the monks did that. Well, my feeling was probably the nuns were the arrogant monks from past life who created the concept called inferior nuns. So it's like a bit like a game, really, if you think about it. If we're neither male or female, we create ourselves all the time. We create the cause to be who we are, you know. So we've invented these labels, male, female. God didn't do it. Buddha didn't do it. George Bush didn't do it. It's a collective creation. But it's not a definitive truth, you know. It's not a definitive truth. It's a spatial, contextual, space and time historical thing. I mean, that's just some of the... Does that make sense to you? Does it make sense, honey? Good. Go on, please. Yes.
Okay. Rabina, I'm driving down the freeway today, and I'm noticing that I'm very, very self-centered. Uh-huh. I want to keep my spot in the freeway. I don't want this guy to cut in front of me or whatever, and so I'm just keeping my place.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just very conscious of, today I've been very conscious of how self-centered I am all the time. So is there a way above that, out of that, through that, beyond that?
Well, seeing the problem is the first thing. And that's already amazing. I think once we see the problem and we get some kind of realization of it, and then are accurate in our assessment of the problem, I mean, the guilt within us when it's deluded, the guilt is, oh my God, I'm such a terrible person, I'm so self-centered. That's too extreme, you know? Just like the other view that says, oh my God, I'm so special. That's too extreme. But we are special and we are self-centered. So we have to not exaggerate it. And this is the same with the male-female. We're not to exaggerate it, make it more than it is. So if we see it as it is, it's a very empowering thing. Then learn to act, learn to go again. So it's like if you're in the lane and you start to see yourself diverging into the wrong lane. You've seen the problem. Oh, I'm so silly, I'm diverging, into, I'm going to the wrong lane. What would you do? Bring yourself back. You'd adjust. Okay, so adjust it. Think of others. Every time you observe it, you go against it. Little bit, like a little bit. It's not as if you concretely, in and of yourself, are self-centered. You observe that tendency within you, along with your other tendencies for perfection and kindness and love and bliss as well. So learn to know which ones you want to grow. Every time you see the other one, you go against. Little bit by little bit. And then you rejoice. Then you let go. Then one little bit of adjustment done. Okay, and then slowly, slowly.
Okay, so if I notice, so I'm driving along and I notice that I'm kind of like wanting to not let this guy in, I should
yep.
do the opposite.
Yeah, well,
so just
I mean,
kind of
yep.
off and I'm
yeah.
like,
I mean, don't go all extreme and start stopping and, you know, apologizing and be exaggerate. Just kind of yeah. observe it okay. and then adjust. Allow the person in if it's appropriate. Rejoice. Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Like that, exactly.
I just wanted to thank you for being here tonight. Your words are very inspiring. I don't mean to beat a dead dog or whatever, but about feminism.
Yes.
Because I really do believe, I believe that Buddhism and feminism are completely compatible, or I
mm-hmm.
hope so.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that even though I don't really believe in the intrinsicness of
mm-hmm.
gender,
mm-hmm.
that it's... it feels to me like a compassionate practice, feminism, the love of maybe a gender that for whatever reason has been subjected to a lot of
mm-hmm.
suffering. And I
mm-hmm.
hope, I don't know, you know, like to bring like Tara, who chooses, mm-hmm. not me like Tara, but correct me if I'm wrong, that Tara chose to come back in the female incarnation,
yes.
given the choice
mm-hmm.
that she had reached.
Yep.
An option to come back as male, and she said, no, I would like to come back.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to be able to transform my feminism into such a love for other women, and yet how does that contradict this idea that we don't have an intrinsic gender?
Doesn't contradict. I don't think it contradicts. I think it's nothing wrong, you know. I mean, we all have different connections with different groups of people enduring different lives. Some of us, it might be, you know, the labels we use. It could be working class people. It could be people in prison. It could be females. It could be males. It could be, I mean, we define groups in different ways. And we have certain connection in certain lives to do certain jobs. Well, happily do it. But in the mind, see, usually we have this either-or view.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say the Dalai Lama, he's Tibetan. So clearly he's got a special connection with people labeled Tibetan. But this doesn't mean he therefore dislikes Americans. He actually, in his mind, has equal compassion and love for all, if he is what he is, which is said to be a Buddha. But due to the karmic connection he has at this particular time in this life, he's got that group whom he identifies with. So go for it. Nothing wrong. But have the bigger view there too.
Thank
you.
You
see my point?
Yes.
No
and
contradiction.
And if you wouldn't mind speaking a bit about the Prison Liberation Project
okay.
and how some of us could get involved, if that's possible.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, in 1996, when I was editor of Mamzala, the magazine of the FPMT, which Tsetsen Ling is a part of and which I'm a part of, that's the organization of Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, I received a letter from a young Mexican prisoner in Pelican Bay, which is a prison, one of the top security prisons in Northern California, right near Oregon. Now, I think this was built maybe 15 years ago, especially to take the troublemakers off the other prisons, which mostly means gangsters, especially in California. Huge gang activity in the prisons. And I think Mexicans and the black gangs mostly, I think. So he was maybe 18 at the time, and he was in this half the prison is what they call security housing, where they're in their cells 23 hours a day and have 1 hour in another cell, basically, for exercise. And many of them have life sentences in there, the heavy-duty dudes, the mafia and the other gangsters. So he'd read a book of Loving Ishi, and he'd found our address there, and he wrote, and he seemed quite sincere, so I wrote him back and sent him a book, and then I visited, then he took refuge, and then by the end of the year we had 40 people on our mailing list, you know. So it's just kind of evolved from that. So now it's, 6 years, whatever it is now, that what we do, we call ourselves Liberation Prison Project, which is the name that Lama Zopa gave us when we became a separate entity. We're now a non-profit. We've just moved, as I said, back to California, to San Francisco. That was when I was in Santa Cruz. We have mainly one person, Kathy, who's a nun here. Where is she? Somewhere. There she is. She's working with me now for, I don't know, 27 years or three, wasn't it? I always think like 27 years. Maybe two, three. Then there's another person here, Sandra, who's working for us half-time, and we have different people coming and going all the time, you know. But we're just touching the surface of what we can do. I mean, it's just we are struggling to keep alive, you know, and I'm not miserable about it. It's okay. But last year, I think we spent something like $100,000, every cent of it raised by individuals, and most of it spent on books. So one of the things we do, we're extremely generous, which we think is really important, with materials, with books. So people write to us, basically. We get maybe now, these days, 200 letters a month at the moment because we haven't got staff or funding, but we're aiming towards it, we're moving towards it. We can't answer even the very first letters that come to us, you know. So we build up communication. We have several monks and nuns who write. We build up communication with people in prison. We try to write to them personally. We send them books. We try to gear the books to their needs. We then send videos, audio tapes. And then they begin, you know, once we get more serious, start to study, then start a group. We support their group. We work with a chaplain. So it's just kind of evolved in that way. Maybe there are 4,000 people, 3,000, I don't know, on our mailing list that we've helped. And what is most interesting, maybe 10 of them are women. 10 total have written to us ever. Maybe 20, I don't know, very, very few, and I do not know the reason. It's most curious because it's all word of mouth. We've also started branches now in Australia. When I go there to teach, there's various, you know, it's very interesting in Australia. There's a lot more interest in Australia in Buddhism than in this country, I'd say, per head. It's interesting. And much more support from the authorities. And in New Zealand, we've got a branch, and also in England. And then recently when I was in Russia, there's a man in St. Petersburg who's been trying to help prisoners there, and they're in an appalling state. And so we offered $500 to him to start a fund to make books, and we've also started a fund in Mongolia to help the families of prisoners. So it's just sort of just touching the surface. I mean, if we had $1 million now, we have to struggle to not, you know, struggle to overspend. Not to overspend. So somehow so that's what we do. We help people individually who write to us, who then start groups. I mean, it's Buddhist-oriented, very clear. We're very focused on what we're doing. But our real wish is to help people in appalling situations learn to find their potential. And this is something that I'm finding extremely inspiring. The number of people, I cannot tell you. We'll all feel that, you know. That extremely, I mean, when you really have nothing left is when you often find who you really are. And I've seen this again and again and again. Just extraordinary, actually. And it really also brings home very strongly this idea of suffering. That Lama Zopa Rinpoche, when I asked him to send a card to this young man for his 21st birthday, he sent him several cards, actually. And in it, he basically, I'm paraphrasing, said something like, "Your prison," and he's in his cell 23 hours a day, okay? And as far as they're concerned, he won't get out until he dies. He said, "Your prison is nothing in comparison to the prison of ordinary people." And that's us, you know, the prison of attachment, the prison of depression, the prison of pride, the prison of anger. And somehow it's something they really understand. And when we really look into our minds, we understand it too. And the number of examples of extraordinary people, you know. One woman I read about, I don't know her, she's a yoga practitioner. I read it in some magazine. She was accused of murdering somebody and was given the death sentence. In fact, she was innocent and she got out 17 years later or something. But for the first years, I think, or maybe months, she said she was out of her mind with rage. And then slowly, from her own side, she came to realize, as she said, "I am not a prisoner. I am a monk. I am not in a cell. I am in a cave." She realized that her mind was hers and that she could change that, and that it had nothing to do with being in this cell, nothing to do with being on death row, you know. And that's the thing that really, for me, is so very appropriate, this whole Buddhist approach. And like one of the mantras almost that we hear from these prisons is it's been their wake-up call. And this is the thing about the complacency we all tend to have when our life is just really fine and dandy. We don't even know we're suffering until you lose it. That's the subtlety, that's the tragedy of attachment. When as long as we can get the junk, as long as we can get the fix, we think we're happy. But the moment we don't get it is when we notice, therefore, the suffering of attachment. And so, of course, when you're chucked into prison and your freedom is gone, you really notice your suffering. So then you can start to make changes, you know. So for me, it's extremely inspiring. So that's what we do. And we just, you know, survive month to month. At the moment, we've a very kind person from Marin who's a professional grant writer has offered her services to us, and we've got good people starting to work for us now. So it's, we're kind of moving in a nice, we're trying to build up a proper infrastructure, you know, to really develop strongly into the future. So how to help? Oh, sorry. How to help? Just saying.
You gone?
No, I don't know. I'm gone. You talk. Don't matter. Okay.
Do you feel that those who are seriously mentally ill can use the techniques of which you speak to bring themselves back to at least a normal state or a state of even enlightenment, such as which you speak?
I understand. Well, it depends what you mean, of course, by seriously mentally ill. Do you mean a person who's born with really limited ability of the mind, who really has never been able to change very much? You mean like that? Or you just mean a person who's very extremely depressed or paranoid or something?
I'm talking about a person such as somebody with bipolar or somebody with schizophrenia.
Oh, okay.
Like a developmental.
I understand. Well, I don't know. You know, bipolar, that's interesting, you know. I understand. I mean, that was called manic depressive once, wasn't it? Well, me and my six siblings were all called manic depressive. This doctor in Melbourne was just thought he'd hit the lottery. You know, he'd got seven of us. And he diagnosed us all as manic depressive. So he gave us all lithium. But that was when I was a lesbian, a feminist, and I hated men. I was not going to take his stupid medicine, so I refused to take his lithium. So for me, this is not for me. This is the Buddhist answer to bipolar, is that it's just extreme attachment, swinging, going up to its highs, and out of control, because this is how we're born, with out of control minds, extreme attachment energy, which is the excited, over-exaggerated fantasy mind, and then extreme crashing. This is exactly samsara, you know. So it's sort of interesting, again, in our culture we call, there's a bipolar person, oh my God, I'm ill, but there's me who's normal. It's not. It is really a question of degree, and I'm trying to belittle or limit that. And indeed it's true, there's so much suffering, I mean the children these days, but it seems to me the approach in the West is that drugs, nothing wrong. If you can take any drug that'll help you calm down your energy to help you work on your mind, please go for it. Take your serotonin, take your Prozac, not a problem, you know, for depression or whatever. But the Buddhist view is it's the mind. So I'm talking now there's things like, you know, schizophrenia is another story. Let's look at that in a minute, just briefly. But things like bipolar, things like depression, they're states of mind, you know. Not to feel bad about it. It's just how we are due to our past karma, our tendencies, external circumstances, our inability to look into our minds, lacking methods, and then the belief that it's the chemical thing only. But the Buddha would say, of course, you can say chemical. In Tibetan medicine, they call it the imbalance of the energies of the elements, you know. It's the same as the body. And the body and mind clearly have an intimate relationship. So, yes, if you can take things to calm down the chemical / elements, nothing wrong. But now it gives you the space to work on your mind. And so this is where it can be extremely helpful, you know, these kinds of techniques for someone who's, say, called bipolar. Not to see it as some kind of, you know, irreversible thing or a disease. It's simply the human mind, the Buddha says, is what we're all experiencing to some extent. Now, okay, someone like maybe is called schizophrenic who's got, you know, maybe more serious mental suffering, we can see sometimes. Then sometimes there's very little to do in this life. Some people, if there's an inability to really see the mind clearly, an inability to really observe what is going on, inability to make real choices, then maybe that person, due to very strong karma, has been born that way and is kind of limited within that in this life. So the best thing for that person is to have support of others. There's nothing much that person can do to their own mind, maybe, you know. But also incidentally, I mean, it's not much to talk, no time to talk about it, but sometimes the Buddhist view about so-called schizophrenia, hearing voices and all the rest, it simply is indeed hearing voices. They're called spirits, you know, which we think is a bit medieval. all these weird Catholic ideas of exorcism and so on, you know, whatever. But the Christian ones. But this is exactly the Buddhist view. There are countless living beings, some of whom are called spirit, disembodied beings, who due to very strong negativity or attachment are born as a spirit around other humans whom they have karmic connection with. You know, like if you're, they can disturb. It's their power. They're disembodied. They can get into people. They can harm, you know. So a very common part of Tibetan medical system is one of the causes of illness is disturbance from spirits. So, you know, in Tibetan medical systems, there are ways of working with that too, you know. But depends on the person, really, is the answer to your question. Someone else?
What advice would you give to someone who is thinking about becoming a Tibetan Buddhist nun?
Okay.
Really be clear why you want to do it. And I'd say the ideal scenario for wanting to do it would be that a person who really understands that it's the best environment for them to work on their minds. You know, I mean, in the end, we've got different karmic connections with different ways of being. And everybody can practice. We all have to do the same job. Give up attachment, give up anger, give up fears, give up jealousy, grow love, grow compassion, do what we can to benefit others. This is the job we all have. But somehow there's a certain lifestyle called monk or nun, and the major difference is that we take certain vows, you know, no sex, no drugs, no like that, you know, no jazz. I have jazz actually. I refuse to give up jazz. I haven't got a vow for no jazz. It's all right. But you know, you become celibate. You have a vow of celibacy. You have a vow not to kill, not to lie, not to steal, which are mostly the same as lay vows anyway. So the point of being a nun or a monk is that it's the best scenario for that person to really do the job that we're all trying to do. That's all. It's a very personal choice, you know. So I know for myself personally, I can say, that in the beginning it was very clear, since I was a little girl actually, and as soon as I went to Mass, I knew it was my job. I declared I was going to be a priest, you know. It was clear as a bell to me. But everybody laughed, of course. I'm not a boy, right? So I figured, oh, all right, I'll be a nun. So then that diminished by the time I was 15, I started, you know, discovering the world. But then I was 21, I gave up God and chose, you know, sex and drugs, nice boys and everything. And so it was very clear to me, though, in my life, never had the wish for one second to live with a person. I completely into sex and pleasure, but didn't want to live. I didn't want a relationship, didn't want a house, didn't want possessions. I didn't know why. I mean, my family felt sorry for me. You know, I knew I didn't want babies. I didn't have to make the choice. It just didn't occur. So you could say, you know, in Buddhist terms, I had this strong karmic connection with so-called monasticism. And by the time I met Lama Yeshe when I was 31, I'd given up sex with men and women, given up drugs, given up alcohol, given up cigarettes. It was just like the next step. It was very logical for me. So in a way, my life kind of went in that direction, and it made sense. But it's only really over the years of my being a nun that it's become stable, a very stable, logical basis. That for me it is without any question that the best choice that I've made to enable me to do this job really well, to do the job of knowing my mind well, knowing attachment, knowing anger, knowing jealousy, knowing pride, understanding them, going beyond them, and then indeed giving me some capacity, some freedom to be useful to others, you know. So that it's that type of thinking, to really see the advantages and the benefits of it, not see it as some, I mean, many times Westerners, I mean, anybody, become a monk or nun because it's all very romantic, you know, it's all attachment mostly. And then after a while, the bubble bursts, because the nature of attachment is the bubble will burst. So then we give up. Or, not so simplistic, that's not fair like that. Sometimes it's very sincere, and then certain obstacles arise, and it's, you know, one has to give up, that's appropriate, nothing wrong too. So it's just, if you really feel there's some benefit, it really makes sense, you really know it'll be the best scenario to help you give up attachment, give up these things, you know, and then understand the vows, understand a little bit what's involved, and then go one step at a time, you know, that's the main thing.
Thank you. Unfortunately, it's time to bring closure to this evening. I'd like to thank Venerable Rubina for being with us this evening. Thank you very much. And Nina Wise for spending the evening with us as well. And I'd like to thank the sponsors and all of you for being here this evening. Thank you for making this all possible. Venerable Rubina is going to be doing a book signing near the bookshop just outside. So for those of you who are interested in
video
that.
Video signing. A video signing, dear.
Did I say video? Yes, did I say book?
I haven't written a
book. Oh, God, sorry.
My nephew made a video.
Video signing. And if you know, this is the first of six, so there are five more. We hope that you've signed up for those. If not, there's information on that outside. Also, there's information about Sei Chen Ling outside, people to speak to. I'm doing this really fast. I have some little other things here. I have a credit card. If you'd like to reclaim it, Gisella De Domenico, I have it here. I'll give it back. And and that's all. Thank you very much.
Can we sing a prayer, please? A little
yes,
wee prayer?
Yes, of course, yes.
Just sing a little tiny prayer, very short. And again, it's like a series of thoughts. Okay, don't get all religious about me. Don't get all holy on me, please. It's a series of thoughts. And these thoughts are basically saying, and I'm really paraphrasing here, you know, that every moment we've been here is as many karmic seeds we've planted on our mind. So these seeds have gone in. You are a different person that walked in this door, you know, 2 hours ago. You're a very different person because you've planted all these seeds that weren't before. So we make this aspiration that they grow, that we nourish them with our virtue from this moment forward, and that they develop into our innate potential. They develop into our own oak tree, our pure nature developed, you know, for the sake of others. So think like that, this little prayer. And then the second little prayer is making the aspiration that compassion grow and grow. Kewa dinyu dudag lama sange drug gyurne drowa chikyang malupa de. Chog Rinpoche Ma Khe Panam Khe Gyuchi Khe Panyam Pa Me Payang Gong Ne Gong Du Pel Va Shog. Thanks, everybody, very, very much.